Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Democrats in Congress have been scrambling to figure out what to do about health care this week, especially now that the political math doesn't work out so well for them anymore. Well, they may want to start with insurance companies and all those new customers that those customers were promised. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 22nd of January. So glad you could be with us. One of the big selling points of the health care reform bills that came out of both the House and the Senate was the prospect of near universal coverage. Another 30 million Americans would get health insurance, 30 million potential new customers for American insurance companies. With prospects for that reform now somewhat up in the air, you might say, Democrats in Congress are faced with the task of getting insurance companies back on board with a new plan and quite possibly with somewhat less than 30 million new customers. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The health insurance industry supported the health care overhaul when it looked like the industry would get as many as 30 million new customers in the bargain. The insurers' trade group says it still wants to work with the government, possibly on a scaled-back bill. Some Democrats want to include more popular measures, like barring insurers from denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. But insurers say that would require a big pool of healthy customers. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for America's health insurance plans.
For those reforms to work, everybody needs to be required to participate.
And that's where things start unraveling. So assume no big influx of customers for insurance companies, and the customers they do have may be losing their jobs and health insurance. Leighton Koo teaches health policy at George Washington University.
Insurance companies will have fewer and fewer patients over time. In order to make up for that, they'll have to be sort of trying to make a little more per patient, but it still means that they're in for some rough sledding over time.
To avoid going downhill, insurers will have to look into new markets. Les Funtleiter is a healthcare strategist for Miller Tabak.
Companies have talked about actually going to global markets, say China, for instance, which is actually in the midst of its own healthcare reform effort.
But Funtleiter adds that no one's come up with a growth strategy that would counteract the rising number of uninsured. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
In the wake of yesterday's Supreme Court decision on campaign financing, one group of corporate executives is pleading for mercy. Executives from companies as far afield as Men's Warehouse and Playboy say they are already harassed by political fundraisers, and now it's only going to get worse. They have sent a letter to Congress asking for public financing of national elections. There will be some winners out of yesterday's ruling, though, like the companies who will turn all that corporate and union money into political ads. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
With yesterday's Supreme Court decision, the political advertising probably won't get any screechier, but there'll be more of it. How much more? I asked media analyst Jack Myers.
$300 million to $1 billion in incremental spending just this year.
That's on top of a record $2.8 billion spent in 2008. Myers says the midterm elections will be a bright spot for ad firms, TV and radio stations, and billboard companies.
For local media especially, which has been hurting, this has the potential of being a windfall.
The new money won't flow everywhere, though, says Evan Tracy of TNS Media Intelligence.
The stations that are going to benefit are going to be located in states that have a lot of competitive races, or they have a Senate or House seat that has national implications, places like Florida, Ohio, California, Texas, Maine.
Tracy says what's not as clear is who will be spending more. It may not be the best-known companies.
Corporate America is going to have to decide, is this the right thing to do for their businesses to go put a lot of money into political races when they're on one hand laying off employees and having problems on their bottom line.
But Tracy says while public companies subject to board and shareholder scrutiny may hold back, billionaire business titans like George Soros and his counterparts on the right probably won't have any such hesitation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you happen to be listening to this as you drive, please do me a favor and pay extra attention to this next story. Toyota has issued another big recall. It needs to fix faulty gas pedals. This is Toyota's second recall in just 4 months, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
4.8 million. That's the latest tally of how many vehicles Toyota is now recalling. Marianne Keller is an industry consultant. She says calling it bad news lets the company off easy.
It permanently changes perception of Toyota's once rock-solid image for quality.
Among other things, some people have asked whether the first recall for a sudden acceleration problem Toyota's attributed to faulty floor mats was actually caused by something else. Keller says customers might not stop buying Toyotas this minute, but they might think twice about it.
Maybe today you'll consider two or three brands. And it comes at a time when there are legitimate contenders for Toyota in every category of the market.
She estimates it'll cost the company more than $1 billion just to do the repairs, and Toyota still doesn't know exactly how to fix the problem. Mark Challis is a lawyer who's represented families in a suit against Ford. He says the way carmakers work these days, where they only get parts from manufacturers as they need them, can have an effect on recalls, too.
There may be a delay of months before the manufacturers and their suppliers have gotten a sufficient number of replacement parts manufactured and then shipped out to all the dealers so that they can use those to actually implement the recall service.
In the meantime, Toyota's telling drivers who experience sudden acceleration to brake steadily and firmly and then call a dealer. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Right about here is where I say something clever about the stock market's performance this particular day. About the only thing that comes to mind right now is uh-oh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama was in Northeast Ohio today. He was doing a little politicking, following up on his banking announcement from yesterday. The president wants to make big Wall Street banks smaller and limit how much risk they can take. No more trading with their own money. No more running hedge funds or private equity firms. All the stuff that helped the financial industry get itself and the rest of us into so much trouble. Whether his proposals will work or not, well, that's why we've got John Carney here from Cluster Stock. Also, Felix Salmon from Reuters. They're going to help us do our weekly wrap. Gentlemen, good to talk to you again.
Great to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
Now, Mr. Carney, I understand you were out late last night talking to people on Wall Street about these new bank regulations, yes?
Very, very true.
All right. So what is, from the heart of American capitalism, what's the reaction?
The reaction is horror and disgust. They think that it's a reaction to the Massachusetts election, and Barack Obama has turned populist and against them, and they are genuinely horrified.
All right. Well, let's get the objective reaction then, John. I mean, what do you think of the plans?
I think the plans will actually be highly ineffective. I think that it is a lot of talk, but I think as implemented, it probably won't change the way any of the big banks do business.
Well, interesting phrase, as implemented, because, Felix, the way I do the senatorial math, the odds of this thing going anywhere are fairly slim.
The interesting thing is that the Democrats are really in control of whether this goes anywhere more than the Republicans. I somehow can't see a major filibuster attempt by the Republicans on this bill. It would just backfire politically so badly. I can see the Democrats soft-pedaling the whole thing and basically coming up with something which is so weak and going to be enforced so lackadaisically by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury that it'll effectively make very little difference.
Can't talk about this new plan without addressing the politics of it a little bit. If you guys remember the images on television yesterday, you had the president, you had Paul Volcker standing behind him, and then way down off to the president's right someplace was nominally his key economic advisor, the Secretary of the Treasury. Help me out with that one, Felix.
Tim Geithner was, he was way off to the right. Larry Summers was way off to the left. These are the people who've been driving the economic policy up until now. It's clear that the economic policy of the administration is very unpopular in the heartland and among Massachusetts voters and probably among voters in the rest of the country as well. And so now what Barack Obama has done is he's turned to Plan B, which is Paul Volcker.
Plan V, as it were, the Volcker rule.
Plan V.
Yeah, that's right. John, what do you think? Yes, no? Paul Volcker in, out, what?
Paul Volcker is now running the economic policy of the United States, and Tim Geithner is definitely out. You had Tim Geithner staring down at his shoes and Paul Volcker beaming, smiling at that press conference. It was unmistakable.
You and I have talked before about Mr. Geithner's job prospects. You still hold that he's out the day after the election?
I think they want to keep him in place because they want to have somebody to fire when that comes. They're not going to fire Volcker in November, so they want to keep Timmy around.
Well, Timmy, yeah, right. Listen to you. Another political question for you guys. The fate of Ben Bernanke. We had this morning two Democratic senators, Russell Feingold and Barbara Boxer, come out and say they are not going to vote to confirm his appointment to a new term running the Fed. Felix, do you think he's really in trouble, or is this just posturing?
I don't think he's in trouble. I still think he'll get confirmed, but I do think this is just symptomatic of the backlash against the Obama administration's first year's economic policies. And I think that the administration is probably not going to spend a huge amount of political capital trying to shore him up.
Well, and in fact, the president came out today and said, I still think Ben Bernanke is the right man for the job. John, do you think he's in trouble or no?
A week ago, I would have said that there's no way Ben Bernanke doesn't get confirmed. Now, I think it's a serious question. Senators are turning against him. When they want something to happen, they have a way of making it sound like it will definitely happen. That's not what you're hearing from the senators right now or from the Democratic leadership. So I think that's a sign that it may be the end of Ben Bernanke's career at the Fed.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Felix Salmon at Reuters. Bun weekend, boys.
Thank you, Guy.
Thanks a lot.
The beautiful people are up in Park City, Utah this weekend. The Sundance Film Festival opened there yesterday. At an opening night screening, founder Robert Redford said he has felt Sundance has been slipping the past couple of years. Too much big studio money, he said, getting in the way of good indie filmmaking. That being the case, Mr. Redford is probably not so pleased about GlaxoSmithKline going Hollywood. The pharmaceutical company, one of whose products is the fat-blocking pill Ally, is funding a documentary about, you know, wait for it now, the hazards of mindless and emotional eating. Glaxo is making the scene at Sundance this weekend to drum up a little celebrity support. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner reports.
GlaxoSmithKline is bankrolling a documentary it hopes will do for obesity what An Inconvenient Truth did for global warming. The drug maker doesn't care so much if you actually see the movie, so long as you talk about it. The impact of An Inconvenient Truth had more to do with the events around the film, says media analyst Johanna Blakely at the University of Southern California.
An Inconvenient Truth is an excellent example of a documentary that not many people really saw, but everybody was talking about it because it was getting so much coverage in the media, and part of that was driven by these house parties.
House parties, private screenings, and other forums for discussions about obesity. That's what GlaxoSmithKline is aiming for. Karen Skolick is one of the few Glaxo executives who was not on a plane to Sundance this morning.
So my hope, our hope, would be that there is a new level of collective consciousness that is raised by using such a creative vehicle.
And a new level of sales for Glaxo's drug, Ally. Sales have been hampered by the drug's yucky side effects. Google poopy in the pants on YouTube and you'll see the PR problem. This year, Ally revamped its ad campaign. Instead of focusing on the drug, it focuses on our unhealthy relationship to food.
First, you become more conscious of what you eat. Then, at every meal, Ally stops some of the fat from being absorbed.
Skolick says building buzz at Sundance is just the first step in starting a national conversation about how we eat, brought to you by GlaxoSmithKline. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up, weighing a new price for printer's ink.
All of this lack of clarity in the what should be required to be labeled on a printer ink cartridge or a toner cartridge used in copiers led me to feel that maybe this should be addressed.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slumped 2% today, 216 points, closed at 10,172. The NASDAQ skidded 2 2/3%, 60 points, closed at 2205. The S&P 500 crumbled 2%, 24 points, 1,091. The Dow is negative for the year, by the way. For the week, the Dow fell 4 1/10%. The NASDAQ lost 3 6/10%. The S&P 500 lagged 3.9% behind. Credit card companies got sideswiped on predictions that revenues would fall in the sector. Capital One plunged 12%. American Express dropped 8% today. McDonald's rose 0.3% after it reported a profit and good sales numbers. General Electric sparked 0.5% higher after its profits beat expectations. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly report on existing home sales. A Green Car Summit takes place in Washington. It aims to steer attention to electric and advanced vehicles. And the Los Angeles Lakers are scheduled for a visit at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The fast food industry lost a pioneer this week. Glenn Bell Jr. died this past Monday. About 50 years ago, he started selling tacos out the side window of a hamburger stand that he owned in San Bernardino, California. What eventually became Taco Bell helped introduce millions of people to Mexican food. And while there may be or is some debate about how good the food at Taco Bell is, commentator Gustavo Arellano says that's kind of besides the point.
For many foodies, Taco Bell belongs in the pantheon of all-time anti-Mexican conspiracies. A notch below Lou Dobbs, but more onerous than the swine flu. These custodians of cuisine and culture bemoan how it cheapens one of the world's great food traditions, with chalupas and enchiladas, its volcano menu and cheese roll-ups. And how insulting was that darn Chihuahua campaign from a couple of years ago? Yo quiero Taco Bell? Muy, muy racist. But with the recent death of Taco Bell's founder, Glenn Bell, this whiner thinks it's high time to praise the fruits of his creation. When Bell sold his first crunchy taco in 1951, Americans outside the Southwest didn't know much about Mexico, beyond Hollywood's banditos and spicy señoritas. Then Bell, a white man with a burger stand in a San Bernardino, California barrio, saw an opportunity. Imitators soon sprung up. Now, tacos and Doritos and salsa and burritos are as American as pizza, gracias to Taco Bell. I'll make an even bolder claim. Taco Bell and its spawn became a gateway for Americans to accept Mexicans. Hasn't been an easy ride, of course, but went smoothed by an endless stream of refried beans and nacho cheese. Because if you can enjoy the cuisine of newcomers, then surely you can start thinking of them as fellow citizens, right? I ate at Taco Bell the other night for the first time in years, to honor Glenn Bell. My burrito still contained bland pinto beans and cheese that tasted like chalk. But in front of me at the drive-thru were whites, Asians, blacks, even Mexicans, all trying to grab a slice, scratch that, a taco, of America. Here's hoping they douse their grub at home, though, with actual salsa, instead of whatever the hell border sauce fire is. It's still Taco Bell.
Gustavo Arellano is a staff writer at the OC Weekly. He writes a column called Ask a Mexican. Write to us. Let us know what you think. Our website is marketplace.org. When you go into a store in this country to buy something, the price you pay is pretty much the price that's on the item in question. other than maybe cars, there's usually not a whole lot of room for negotiation. So it will surprise you not at all to learn that the pricing mechanisms for virtually everything in this economy are tilted heavily in favor of the people doing the selling. William Poundstone explores our understanding of why we pay what we pay in his new book. It's called The Myth of Fair Value. Bill, it's good to have you with us.
Yes, good to be with you.
Is there such a thing as fair value? I mean, that's the nub of this book.
Yeah, well, I started researching this thinking there was, but then when you look at the psychology and what they've found in the past 20 years, you really begin to doubt that.
Well, tell me about the psychology then. I mean, what are the experiments that let us know we're getting ripped off, basically?
Yeah, they started looking into how people make decisions, and they found that perceptions of value can be very easily manipulated by the context of the situation. To give an example, if you're looking at flat-screen TVs, and you see one that's marked $800, mm-hmm. and next to it is one marked $1,000 with a $200 rebate, most people will prefer the rebate. So that's why about 30% of all TVs now are sold with these rebate coupons.
So these guys were watching when I was shopping for my flat screen a couple of months ago.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
That's exactly what happened to me. But, I mean, it goes down to a jar of peanut butter, too. I mean, you talk about that in your book as well.
Yeah, exactly. They found that every time a company has to raise prices, people are inclined to switch brands or switch stores. So what price consultants, as they call them, recommend that companies do is make the package just a little smaller. If you get a Skippy's peanut butter jar and turn it over, you'll see that there's now a dent in the bottom. And the whole purpose of that is so that there's an ounce and a half less peanut butter in there, which means that they could keep the so-called same price. So as long as you don't realize they've raised the price, people are happy.
Context is everything. You have this great diagram of a menu, I think, from a New York City restaurant. You break down, you know, which price is where and why it's all set out. It's all about how the consumer perceives that data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, menus are an area where price consultants have had a huge effect. They've found that if they use centered justification of the menu items so that the prices don't end up all in a straight column, you pay a little less attention to them. So you're more inclined to order what you really want, which often tends to be kind of expensive.
You call text messaging the greatest con in American consumer economy today.
Exactly. I looked at how much a text message really should cost in economic terms based on the price you pay for bandwidth from a cell phone. And it comes to about 1/1,000th of a penny. So rounded to the nearest penny is free. But obviously, people are actually paying a lot more than that. It averages around 20 cents each.
Yeah. Once again, you've been in my house and you're seeing how my personal economy works. Has any of this changed in the last 2 years since the economy really went for the worst?
Well, if anything, it's become more important because you have to find people ways to motivate people to buy when they really do have, you know, more limited funds now. So you have rebates, you have so-called 30% discounts, 40% discounts, because that's what people want to hear.
When they are sitting in those back rooms trying to figure out how to price something and strategizing about the marketing, I mean, what goes through their mind? What is that decision matrix that they have?
Well, it's become very empirical today because when they introduce barcodes and internet sales, now they've got all this data and they look and see, you know, we had this promotion and it caused so much more sales. We had this promotion and no one noticed. So they really know what affects people's decisions, and they make the most of that.
William Poundstone, his book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, so true story. My 11-year-old had a school project due the other day. 11-year-olds being 11-year-olds. That means he didn't get around to printing it until the night before, which explains why I was running out to the office supply store at 8 o'clock that night to buy a new ink cartridge. Ours, of course, had run dry with no notice. $35 later, we were all set. But wouldn't it be great if you could actually tell when one of those things was getting set to expire? As it happens, the National Conference on Weights and Measures meets this weekend, and it will take up the case of the humble ink cartridge. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
So I have a small Dell home printer, and looking at the cartridge that's in there now, it doesn't say anything about either how many pages it could print or how much ink it contains. The packaging doesn't say anything either. The National Conference on Weights and Measures would like to change that. It sets standards for weighing and measuring everything from mulch to hydrogen to pasta. Max Gray heads Florida's Bureau of Weights and Measures. He says when it comes to ink cartridges, the labeling rules are fuzzy. Manufacturers can say as much or as little as they want about how much ink is in the cartridge or how it performs.
All of this lack of clarity in the what should be required to be labeled on a printer ink cartridge or a toner cartridge used in copiers led me to feel that maybe this should be addressed.
So consumers know what they're getting for their money and can start to compare cartridges side by side like products in, say, the supermarket. Charles LeCompte of Lira Research says manufacturers will not be keen to clarify on packaging how far their ink goes.
They realize it's going to set in motion a dynamic that will drive down cartridge prices over time, which is what they fear the most. They like their business model.
Ink brings in a lot of money. It has to be replenished all the time. LeCompte says ink is a big reason why HP's printer division is three times as profitable as its PC division. Dean Galley heads computer testing at Consumer Reports. He says he's never calculated how much consumers pay per ounce of ink, but
it's way, way up there. It's probably one of the most expensive liquids that you can buy.
If you dig around on manufacturer websites, you can get an idea of a cartridge's lifespan. An HP 96 cartridge, for instance, churns out a maximum of 860 plain black pages, according to HP's website. The cartridge costs about $34. Another cartridge from a different manufacturer might cost $20 and print 285 pages. Galley says manufacturers should focus on the number of pages you can print rather than how much ink each cartridge contains, because that doesn't tell people how long the cartridge will last.
The number of pages that you get per unit volume of ink can vary between the different ink formulations and the different manufacturers. So it's not a clear indication of what the page count would be.
All this and other weighty matters like pelletized ice cream and moisture loss in dried pasta will be considered when the National Conference on Weights and Measures meets this weekend. Printer manufacturers and ink producers will also be there to consider the labeling issue. But it could be a while before consumers can compare cartridges based on their labels. The National Conference won't vote on the matter till July at the earliest. I'm Ashley Milne-Tide for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a mention of the Haiti telethon this evening. It'll be on all the major networks tonight and a couple of minor ones, too. Political stars, movie stars, and celebrities of all stripe will be on. Lots and lots of music as well. Everybody from Stevie Wonder to Taylor Swift. Performances which, of course, will be available on iTunes for 99 cents after the show, although those proceeds are going to go to Haiti, too. And that is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 216 points. That is 2%. The NASDAQ off 60 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 24 points, 2% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, in a culture obsessed with home ownership, a renter's revolt is brewing.
It just makes so much more sense to rent and have money for retirement, money for our children's college fund.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.